between the door and the president. I immediately sprang towards him and seized him. He wrested himself from my grasp and made a violent thrust at my breast with a large knife. I parried the blow by striking it up and received a wound several inches deep in my left arm, between the elbow and the shoulder. A little over 2 years later, on June 17, 1867, Rathbone dusted off his script and delivered the following testimony at the trial of John Surratt. Quote, "On the evening of the 14th of April, about 20 minutes past 8, I, in the company with Miss Harris, left my residence at the corner of 15th and 8th Streets, joined the President and Mrs. Lincoln, went with them in their carriage to Ford's Theater on 10th Street. On entering the box, there was a large armchair, placed nearest the audience and furthest from the stage. When the second scene of the third act was being performed, and while I was intently observing the performance on the stage, I heard the report of a pistol from behind me, and on looking around, I saw dimly through the smoke the form of a man between the President and the door. I immediately sprung towards him and seized him. He wrested himself from my grasp, and at the same time, made a violent thrust at me with a large knife. I parried the blow by striking it up and received it on my left arm, between the elbow and the shoulder, and received a deep wound." In the end, though, the government's brazen attempts to corrupt the proceedings failed to pay dividends, and the jury was left hung 8-4 in a favor of acquittal. Even with the obviously perjured testimony, the manufactured evidence, and the wildly inappropriate jury instructions, the state was only able to secure 4 votes for conviction. And Surratt had found himself a number of new fans. As Eisenschimmel noted, quote, "The ladies of Washington considered him to be quite attractive and thronged the courtroom. John Harrison Surratt walked out of court a free man, and the state quietly opted not to further pursue the charges. 5 years later, he married Mary Victorine Hunter, a second cousin of none other than Francis Scott Key, whose son's murderer, it will be recalled, was defended by Edwin Stanton. Key's great-great-granddaughter, Pauline Potter, by the way, later married Baron Philippe de Rothschild, of the infamous Rothschild banking family. Surratt lived to the ripe old age of 72, passing away, curiously enough, on April 21, 1916, precisely 50 years to the day from when he had been identified in Rome as a member of the Papal Zouave. It is said that he had penned a biography, but he supposedly opted to burn it a few days before his death. In a similar vein, Robert Todd Lincoln is said to have burned all of his father's private papers shortly before his own death, because, I suppose, one wouldn't want the truth about the assassination of one's father to reach the public domain. And that concludes part 4 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab, jump down to Lincoln, and feel free to pick up with us next time in part 5. Feel free to click on the Books tab to purchase a book or make a donation to support the late David McGowan's family and work. As always, thank you for joining me. My name is Mark. You've been listening to the Pure Grace Podcast. We look forward to catching you next time. Take care. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today we'll be picking up in part 5 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong by David McGowan. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab, and scroll down to Lincoln to pick up with us in part 5. Let's jump right in. Defense attorney John H. Bradley, whom we met in the last installment, had this to say to the jury and spectators at John Surratt's trial, quote, "Who was John Wilkes Booth? He was a man of polished exterior, pleasing address, highly respectable in every regard, received into the best circles of society, his company sought after, exceedingly bold, courteous, and considered generous to a fault, a warm and liberal-hearted friend, a man who had obtained a reputation upon the stage." Unquote. The woman who once reported him for rape in Philadelphia, and the irate, jealous husband who once severely throttled him in Syracuse, New York, might disagree. Francis Wilson, one of Booth's biographers, author of John Wilkes Booth, Fact and Fiction of Lincoln's Assassination, posed the following question. How is it possible for Booth to obtain such power over a fellow human being as to command him to perform an act of murder, and to know that that command would be enthusiastically obeyed? A little over a century after the assassination of Lincoln, prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi would ponder the very same question about a guy by the name of Charlie Manson. Quote, "I tend to think that there is something more, some missing link that enabled him to so rape and bastardize the minds of his followers that they would go against the most ingrained of all commandments, thou shalt not kill, and willingly, even eagerly, murder at his command." A friend of Booth's from childhood, John Deary, said that the John Wilkes Booth that he knew, quote, "cast a spell over most men with whom he came in contact, and I believe all women without exception," unquote. Really, excuse me, my neighbors are having a little Halloween party this afternoon. Any screaming you hear in the background over the traffic. I record these on my back porch, so apologies if it's a hindrance in any way. So who was this charismatic enigma known as John Wilkes Booth? The man known to history as possibly the most famous assassin who ever lived. Just about everyone knows that he was an actor, one of the finest and arguably the most popular of his generation. But he was much more than just that, a fact obscured by the century and a half focus on John Wilkes Booth, the actor. In reality, John Wilkes Booth, and the Booth family in general, were very deeply tied to the power structures in Washington and London, and had been for a very, very long time, and they still are today. Booth's most famous ancestor was undoubtedly his namesake, John Wilkes, who lived from October 17, 1725, until December 26, 1797. Throughout his life, Wilkes served as a member of Parliament, a judge, a journalist and essayist, and the Lord Mayor of London. A revered statesman, Wilkes was also a member of the Hellfire Club and a noted libertine. Other notable libertines throughout history include the Marquis de Sade, Aleister Crowley, and Anton LaVey. That would be the same Hellfire Club that included as a member a founding father by the name of Benjamin Franklin. And that would be the same Benjamin Franklin whose London home from that era yielded the remains of at least 10 bodies, 6 of them children. It was the Hellfire Club, by the way, that first coined the phrase, "Do it thou wilt," which was later appropriated by Aleister Crowley. And it was the Hellfire Club that was widely rumored during its heyday to be conducting black masses and other occult satanic rituals, along with drunken orgies and various other acts of debauchery. John Wilkes was also notable for being considered during his lifetime as the ugliest man in all of England. He never, though, suffered from a shortage of beautiful female companions. Aside from a 9-year marriage, Wilkes remained single for his 72 years on this planet and was considered quite the ladies' man, fathering an unknown number of children. Like his descendant and namesake, Wilkes apparently had a knack for casting a spell over women. Two other of John Wilkes Booth's famous ancestors were Henry Booth, the first Earl of Warrington, who lived from 1652 to 1694, and his son George Booth, who lived from 1675 to 1758 and succeeded his father as the second and last Earl of Warrington. At various times during his life, Henry Booth served as a member of Parliament, a member of the Privy Council of England, a noted writer, and a mayor. John Wilkes Booth was also descended from Barton Booth, who lived from 1681 to 1733, and who was described by one biographer as, quote, the most popular actor with the English royalty known to history. Many generations later, namesake Sidney Barton Booth, a son of Junius Brutus Booth Jr., would become an actor and writer of some renown before passing away in 1937. The alleged assassin's grandfather was Richard Booth, an eccentric English barrister with a fondness for alcohol, a fondness that would be shared by his son, Junius Brutus Booth, and by his grandson, John Wilkes Booth. Junius was born in London in 1796 and was performing on stage by the age of 17. At 19, he married Marie-Christine Adelaide Delannoy. Less than 5 months later, she bore him his first child, who died in infancy, as would a number of Junius Brutus Booth's offspring. In June 1821, at the age of 25, Junius set sail for America with his mistress, Mary Ann Holmes, leaving behind his wife and only surviving child, Richard Junius Booth. Junius and Mary Ann would pose as man and wife for the next 30 years, producing no fewer than 10 illegitimate offspring, 4 of whom didn't make it through childhood. The pair weren't actually married until 1851, the year Junius finally divorced his actual wife, and were married just 1 year before Junius passed away in November 1852. During his lifetime, Junius was considered to be one of the finest actors of his generation. He was also regarded as a playwright, a scholar, philosopher, and linguist. Named for one of the most notorious assassins of all time, Junius once set a fine example for son John by sending a letter to then-President Andrew Jackson, threatening to slit his throat and or have him burned at the stake. And he thoughtfully signed that letter and included a return address. It was, nevertheless, dismissed as either a hoax or a joke. Junius and Mary Ann purchased a 150-acre estate in Maryland that would ultimately feature a large pool, stables, and a Gothic home known as Tudor Hall, listed in the National Register of Historic Places. Junius began construction on the home shortly before his death, and so never lived there, though his offspring, including John Wilkes Booth, did. Ned Spengler, it will be recalled, was involved in the construction of the home. John Wilkes Booth, the 9th of Junius and Mary Ann's 10 offspring, was born on May 10, 1838. A well-educated young man, he was regarded as an excellent horseman and marksman, as well as a talented athlete. Like his father, he made his acting debut at 17, in an 1855 production of Richard III. By 1861, he was considered one of the most popular actors in America, and there was considerable demand for his services. On December 2, 1859, John Wilkes Booth was among the soldiers standing guard on the scaffold when probable agent provocateur John Brown was hanged. Booth was not a soldier, though. He purportedly either borrowed or stole a militia uniform and posed as a soldier to secure the position. On March 4, 1865, Booth found himself prominently placed among the onlookers at Lincoln's second inaugural address. He was there as a guest of U.S. Senator John P. Hale. Unknown at the time was that Booth was secretly engaged to Hale's daughter, Lucy Hale. Senator Hale had worked closely with fellow Senator William Seward before Seward's appointment as Secretary of State. Notably, Hale was a Northern senator representing New Hampshire, and he was known for his staunchly abolitionist views. It makes perfect sense, then, that his daughter would be engaged to an alleged Confederate operative. During John Wilkes Booth's lifetime, there was another member of the Booth-Wilkes clan who achieved considerable amount of public notoriety. Charles Wilkes was a U.S. naval officer who ultimately attained the rank of Rear Admiral, as well as a celebrated explorer who led the United States exploring expedition from 1838 to 1842. He was also a great-nephew of John Wilkes, making him a blood relative of John Wilkes Booth and his numerous siblings. Charles Wilkes was raised by his aunt, Elizabeth Ann Seton, who was a woman of considerable social prominence, who later became the first American-born woman to be canonized by the Catholic Church. In the 1820s, Wilkes counted among his associates a genocidal Grand Master Mason by the name of Andrew Jackson, the same Andrew Jackson who was also, by some reports, a friend of Junius Brutus Booth, the guy who jokingly threatened to assassinate him. Many years later, another member of the Booth clan, Teresa Cara Booth, was born on September 23, 1954. Teresa is a direct descendant of Algernon Booth, Junius Brutus Booth's brother and John Wilkes Booth's uncle. She became an attorney in 1976 and a member of the Queen's Council in 1995. 2 years later, Teresa Booth, better known as Cherie Blair, wife of Tony Blair, became the First Lady of Downing Street. Nothing unusual about that, I suppose. In the aftermath of the Lincoln assassination, actors were viewed with considerable suspicion across the country. The entire cast of Our American Cousin was arrested, and numerous other productions closed for a time due to the lynch mob mentality that was sweeping the nation. No one was above suspicion, and, as previously noted, more than 2,000 people were arrested as possible co-conspirators. Those with only the loosest connections to the accused coup plotters were scooped up and held for varying lengths of time. Two of John Wilkes Booth's brothers, Edwin and Junius Brutus Jr., were fellow actors. Clearly, then, they had two big strikes against them, which should have put them at the very top of the government's roundup list, and yet not a single member of the Booth clan was arrested in the frenzy of arrests and accusations. Not one. It always helps to have friends in high places. The op-ed page of the Los Angeles Times apparently now operates as part of a forum for unpaid advertisements for intelligence agency-approved works of fiction. I say that because just a few days ago, that page featured what was essentially a half-page ad for Jeff Bauman's hopelessly fraudulent account of the Boston Marathon bombings. And yesterday, that same page featured a barely disguised advertisement for a book written by a professional liar by the name of Mel Aiton. Aiton has apparently penned a whole series of disinformational books on various presidential assassinations and attempted assassinations. His latest, Hunting the President, Threats, Plots, and Assassination Attempts from FDR to Obama, carries on in that fine tradition. The following paragraph is from the wildly inaccurate op-ed piece. Quote, Lincoln was the first American president to be assassinated, but the motivations that drove his assassin were unfortunately not unique. Understanding the nature of those who want to kill a president goes considerably further toward explaining assassinations than looking to fanciful conspiracy theories. Unquote. Let's now take a peek at what fanciful theory it is that Aiton is pitching. Quote, Booth's desire for fame and recognition is a common theme among assassins. In researching a book on presidential killers and would-be killers, I found that they tended to share certain personality traits. While some had been treated for mental illness, an even more predominant characteristic is that many of them were disillusioned with and resentful of American society after a lifetime of failure. And most of them also had a burning desire for notoriety. Killing an American president, most would-be assassins believed, would win them a place in history, making a somebody out of a nobody, unquote. Every single word of the preceding paragraph can only be described as complete and utter, and I'll paraphrase, lies. Booth already had fame and recognition beyond his wildest dreams. He was far from being a nobody. To the contrary, he was making upwards of $20,000 a year, a staggering amount in those days, and had the love, respect, and admiration of men and women all across the country. He was wealthy, good-looking, supremely talented, and had lived a very charmed life. And given that he was only 26 at the time of the assassination, it's hardly accurate to say that he had faced a lifetime of failure. In truth, he had never known failure at all in his short life. Ayton's body of work is unfortunately typical of what has been written about Lincoln and his alleged assassin over the past 149 years. Listed below, in order of the date of release, are some of the more honest books that have been published, some decidedly better than others. And they are The Escape and Suicide of John Wilkes Booth, 1907 by Finney L. Bates, John Wilkes Booth, Fact and Fiction of Lincoln's Assassination by Francis Wilson, 1929, Why Was Lincoln Murdered by Otto Eisenschimmel in 1937, In the Shadow of Lincoln's Death by Otto Eisenschimmel as well, 1940, The Web of Conspiracy by Theodore Roscoe in 1959, Masked for Treason, The Lincoln Murder Trial by Vaughn Shelton in 1965, and we have The Lincoln Conspiracy by David Balsiger in 1977, and then finally The Return of Assassin John Wilkes Booth by W.C. Jameson in 1999. And that concludes the end of part 5 of Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination is Wrong. As always, jump over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, head over to the Features tab and jump down to Lincoln, and feel free to pick up with us next time in part 6. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we're going to pick up in part 6 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination is Wrong by David McGowan. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab, and jump down to Lincoln to pick up with us here in Part 6. Let's jump right in. The assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, only days after the end of the war, was a terrible tragedy. Much has been speculated about the events leading up to the murder and immediately afterward, but few people know what really happened. So says Bill O'Reilly on page 1 of his tome on the Lincoln assassination. What he doesn't tell readers is that, after reading his novelized account, they will still have no clue what really happened. One thing that O'Reilly opts to leave out of his book entirely is the mockery of a trial held for the alleged conspirators. After spending the first 276 pages of his book covering the period from April 1, 1865, to April 26, 1865, the day Booth was allegedly gunned down at Garrett's barn, O'Reilly then abruptly jumps ahead to July 7, 1865, the day 4 of the alleged conspirators were hanged. Apparently nothing of significance happened in May or June of 1865. Or maybe it's best not to shine too bright a light on one of the most sordid chapters of U.S. history. U.S. Navy Secretary Gideon Welles is on record as stating that Secretary of War Edwin Stanton wanted the alleged conspirators to be, quote, tried and executed before President Lincoln was buried. Convictions were obviously a given. Lincoln was laid to rest on May 4, 1865, 19 days after he died, and just before the trial of the conspirators began, thwarting Stanton's wishes, but justice was dispensed very quickly nonetheless. Stanton favored a military trial, a course of action opposed by various other members of the Lincoln cabinet, including both Welles and Attorney General Edward Bates, who noted that, quote, if the offenders are done to death by that tribunal, however truly guilty, they will pass for martyrs with half the world. Many believe that a military trial would be unconstitutional given that all of the defendants were civilians. Stanton nevertheless prevailed. It would, in fact, be later determined that the proceedings had been unconstitutional, both because the suspects were subjected to military, quote, justice, and because they were denied their right to individual trials. That ruling would not, however, resurrect the 5 alleged conspirators who paid with their lives. While awaiting what passed for a trial, the prisoners were held in appalling conditions aboard 2 ironclad vessels, the Montauk and the Saugus. Except for Mudd and Surratt, who were reportedly held elsewhere and spared the torturous hoods. Very special attention appears to have been paid to Lewis Powell. Throughout his confinement, Powell was personally guarded by Thomas T. Eckert, which is undoubtedly the only time in the nation's history that a sitting assistant secretary of war served as a lowly prison guard. Even more curiously, despite the fact that Powell was kept shackled, hooded, isolated, and otherwise deprived, he was nevertheless allowed to keep a knife while imprisoned. And false reports were circulated indicating that he was suicidal. It's perfectly clear in retrospect that the government had contingency plans to have Powell, quote, suicided if necessary. On May 1, 1865, newly installed President Andrew Johnson ordered that the 8 alleged conspirators face a 9-man military tribunal. The members of that tribunal, 7 generals and 2 colonels, were all handpicked by Stanton. But a couple were unknown to the public, and none of them knew anything about the so-called rule of law or about the evidentiary or procedural rules. That didn't prove to be a problem, though. They just made up the tribunal rules as they went along. As Vaughn Shelton wrote back in 1965, quote, all but 1 or 2 were nearly as unknown then as they are now. There was not a noteworthy war record in the whole group. In fact, the 2 whose names might be recognized by the average reader,
Major General David Hunter, presiding officer, and Major General Lew Wallace, later author of Ben-Hur, had attained rank by political connections, and their names had been associated with military defeats throughout the four-year contest. All appeared to be qualified largely by their prejudices, total ignorance of the law, and subservience to the will of the prosecutors. It was common talk in Washington that the military commission was assembled for the purpose of convicting the accused persons, not to weigh the merits of their cases.